back. How long it would remain so now that the alarm had been sounded in both directions was another matter. Jackson decided to take no chance on being shut off from this richest of all prizes. Leg-weary though the men were, some of them would have to push on through the darkness to Manassas, block the arrival of reinforcements sent by rail from Alexandria, and hold the place until their comrades joined them in the morning. Two of Ewell's regiments drew the duty, or, more strictly speaking, were volunteered for it by their commander, Brigadier General Isaac Trimble. It was Trimble, a 60-year-old Virginia-born Kentucky-raised Marylander, who had wanted to make a twilight charge up the blasted slope of Malvern Hill the month before. Stonewall had restrained him then, but he remained undaunted. "Before this war is over," he declared as the army started northward, "I intend to be a major general or a corpse." He set off into the night, riding out of Bristow at the head of his two footsore regiments, a burly white-haired West Pointer with a drooping black mustache. On second thought, Jackson sent Stuart and his troopers along to support him. Then the rest of the command bedded down, too weary to worry over much about the fact that they were sleeping between an army of 75,000 bluecoats and the capital, whose safety was supposedly that army's first concern. Early next morning, August 27th, leaving the rest of Ewell's division to guard the Broad Run crossing in his rear, Jackson moved on Manassas with the troops of Hill and Tolliver. The sight that awaited them there was past the imagining of Stonewall's famished tatterdemalions. Acres, a square mile, in fact, of supplies of every description were stacked in overwhelming abundance, collected here against the day when the armies of Pope and McClellan combined for another advance on Richmond. Newly constructed warehouses overflowed with rations, quartermaster goods, and ordnance stores. Two spur tracks, half a mile long each, were jammed with more than 100 brand new boxcars, similarly freighted. Best of all, from the point of view of the luxury-starved raiders, sutler wagons parked hub to hub were packed with every delicacy their vanished owners had thought might tempt a payday soldier's jaded palate. There it all was, spread out before the butternut horde as if the mythical horn of plenty had been upended here, its contents theirs for the taking. So they supposed, but when they broke ranks, surging forward, they found that Jackson, frugal as always, had foreseen their reaction and had moved to forestall it by placing Trimble's men on guard to hold them back. For once, though, he had underrated their aggressive instincts. Veterans of harder fights, with infinitely smaller rewards at the end, they broke through the cordon and fell on the feast of good things. Canteens were filled with molasses, haversacks with coffee. Pockets bulged with cigars, jackknives, writing paper, handkerchiefs, and such. However, the chief object of search, amid the embarrassment of riches, was whiskey. This, too, their commander had foreseen, and by his orders the guards staved in the barrels and shattered the demijohns, whereupon the looters dropped to their hands and knees, scooping and sipping at the pools and rivulets before the liquor soaked into the earth or drained away. Some, more abstemious, were satisfied with loaves of unfamiliar light bread, which they ate like cake. Others, preferring a still richer diet, found pickled oysters and canned lobster more to their taste, spooning it up with grimy fingers and washing it down with bottles of Rhine wine. Off to the east, a troublesome federal battery had been banging away in protest all this while. Jackson sent one of his own to attend to it, but presently word came back that enemy infantry was crossing the Bull Run Railroad Bridge and forming for attack. Most of Hill's division was moved out quickly to meet the threat, which turned out to be a brigade of four New Jersey regiments sent down by rail from Alexandria, under a zealous and badly informed commander, Brigadier General George W. Taylor. His orders were to save the bridge, but he decided to press on to the junction itself and drive away the raiders, whom he mistook for cavalry. The Jersey men came on in style, green and eager, not knowing that they were up against the largest and probably the hardest fighting division in Lee's whole army. Jackson opened on them with his guns, prematurely it seemed to little Powell's men waiting with cocked rifles for the interrupters of their feast to come within butchering distance. But the Bluecoats took their long-range losses and kept coming, bayonets fixed and fire in their eyes. Then Stonewall did an unfamiliar thing. Admiring their valor, which he knew was based on ignorance, the charge, he said later, was made with great spirit and determination and under a leader worthy of a better cause. He called a ceasefire and rode out in front of the guns, waving a handkerchief and shouting for the Federals to surrender and be spared extermination. By way of reply, one attacker took deliberate aim and sent a bullet whistling past him. Cured of his lapse into leniency, Jackson rode back and ordered the fire resumed. By now, the Jerseymen were nearer, and this time it was as if they struck a tripwire. Suddenly demoralized, they turned and scampered, devil take the hindmost. Their losses were surprisingly light, considering the danger to which their rashness had exposed them. 200 captured and 135 killed or wounded, including their commander, who, as he was being carried dying to the rear, appealed to his men to rally, and for God's sake prevent another Bull Run. They paid him no mind, nor did Jackson, already burdened with more spoils than he could handle, victim, as it were, of the law of diminishing utility. For once he was unconcerned about pursuit. The whole comic opera affair was over before noon. After burning the railroad bridge to ensure against further interruption from that direction, he brought Hill's men back to the junction, where some measure of order had been restored in their absence. It was maintained, at least for a while the plunderers were held at bay, the ambulances and ordnance wagons, all the rolling stock he had, were filled with such Federal stores as were most needed, principally medical supplies. Once this was done, the rest were thrown open to the troops, who fell upon them, whooping, their appetites whetted by the previous unauthorized foray. Painful as it was to Stonewall, watching the improvident manner in which his scarecrow raiders snatched up one luxurious armload only to cast it aside for another, he was reconciled to the waste by the knowledge that what was rejected would have to be given to the flames. Word had come from Ewell that he was under attack at Bristow from the opposite direction. Jackson knew the time had come to abandon his exposed position for one in which he could await, with some degree of security, the arrival of Longstreet and reconsolidation of the army under Lee. By now, of course, Pope had learned the nature of the explosion in his rear. Instead of heading for the Shenandoah Valley, as had been supposed when the signal station reported a well-closed gray column moving north 2 days ago, Lee had divided his army and sent half of it swinging around the Bull Run Mountains for a strike at Manassas. That half of it was there now, under Jackson. But Pope was not dismayed. Far from it, he was exultant, and with cause. He had 40 brigades of infantry on hand, including a dozen of McClellan's, with others on the way. It seemed to him that Lee, who had less than 30 brigades, 14 in one direction, 15 in another, more than 20 airline miles apart, with 75,000 Federals on the alert between the two segments, had committed tactical suicide. Hurrying to Bristow, where Hooker's division of Heintzelman's corps was skirmishing with the enemy, Pope arrived as night was falling and found that the rebels, soundly thrashed, according to Hooker, had retreated across Broad Run. Encouraged by today's success, he decided to bring up 6 more divisions, and with them crush Jackson's 3 before the sun went down tomorrow. A depot of supplies, however vast, seemed a small price to pay for bait when it brought such a catch within his reach. To Phil Kearney, commanding Heintzelman's other division at Warrenton Junction, went a wire. At the very earliest blush of dawn, push forward, with all speed, to this place. Jackson, A.P. Hill, and Ewell are in front of us. I want you here at day dawn, if possible, and we shall bag the whole crowd. Be prompt and expeditious, and never mind wagon trains or roads till this affair is over. To Reno, at Greenwich, with Burnside's 2 divisions, went another. March at the earliest dawn of day on Manassas Junction. Jackson, Ewell, and A.P. Hill are between Gainesville and that place, and if you are prompt and expeditious, we shall bag the whole crowd. As you value success, be off at the earliest blush of dawn." The third wire went to McDowell, whose three divisions were helping to hold the line of the Rappahannock. "Jackson, Ewell, and A.P. Hill are between Gainesville and Manassas Junction. We had a severe fight with them today, driving them back several miles along the railroad. If you will march promptly and rapidly at the earliest dawn of day upon Manassas Junction, we shall bag the whole crowd. Be expeditious, and the day is our own." Northeastward, exploding ammunition dumps imitated the din of a great battle, and the night sky was lurid with the reflection of a square mile of flames. Jackson's graybacks were evidently staging a high revel, oblivious to the destruction being plotted by their adversary 5 short miles away. But next morning, after fording Broad Run unopposed and marching past the wreckage at Bristow Station, when Pope reached Manassas, all he found was the charred evidence of what one of his staff colonels called the recent rebel carnival. The scene was one of waste and desolation. On the railroad tracks and sidings stood the hot and smoking remains of what had recently been trains of cars laden with ordnance and commissary stores intended for our army. As far as the eye could reach, the plain was covered with boxes, barrels, cans, cooking utensils, saddles, sabers, muskets, and military equipments generally, hard bread and corn pones, meat, salt, and fresh beans, blankets, clothes, shoes, and hats, from brand new articles, just from the original packages, to the scarcely recognizable exuvii of the rebels who had made use of the opportunity to renew their toilets. Of the revelers themselves there was no sign, nor was there agreement among the returning guards and sutlers as to the direction in which they had disappeared. Some said one way, some another. As far as Pope could tell, the earth had swallowed them up. As things now stood, last night's orders would result in nothing more than a convergence on a vacuum. Presently, however, reports began to come in, pinpointing the gray column first in one place, then another, most of them quite irreconcilable. Pope sifted the conflicting evidence, rejecting this, accepting that, and arrived at the conviction that Stonewall was concentrating his three divisions at Centerville. Revised orders went out accordingly, canceling the convergence on Manassas. Centerville was now the place. If they would still be expeditious, the day would still be Pope's. His exuberance and zest were undiminished. He kept his mind, if not his eye, on the prize within his reach. But for others under him, particularly the dust-eating soldiers in the ranks left hungry by the destruction of their commissary stores, the chase, if it could be called such, had already begun to pall. Marched and countermarched since the earliest blush of dawn in pursuit of phantoms, they were being mishandled, and they knew it. The very terrain was of evil memory. It seemed to them that they were heading for a repetition of last year's debacle on these same rolling plains, under some of these same commanders. McDowell, for example. "I'd rather shoot McDowell than Jackson," men were saying. Now as then, they turned on him, muttering imprecations. Nothing about him escaped suspicion, even his hat, a bamboo and canvas affair he had invented to keep his scalp cool in the Virginia heat. They suspected that it was a signaling device to be used for communicating with the rebels or as an identification to keep him from being shot by mistake. That basket, they called it, contemptuous not only of the helmet but also of the general it shaded. Pope has his headquarters in the saddle and McDowell his head in a basket. All through the long hot afternoon of August 28th, Pope kept groping, like the it in a game of blind man's buff, arms outstretched, fingers spread, combing the landscape for the ubiquitous elusive rebel force, to no avail. Riding into Centerville at sunset, in advance of most of the 12 divisions he had slogging the dusty roads, all that is but the two with Banks, which, being still unrecovered from the shock of Cedar Mountain, had been left behind to guard the army trains, he found that he had ordered another convergence on another vacuum. The graybacks had been there, all right, but they were there no longer. They had vanished. Once more, it was as if the earth had swallowed them, except that this time he would have to look for them in darkness, with troops worn down by 14 hours of fruitless marching. Pope felt the first twinges of dismay, not because of fear. He was afraid of nothing, not even Stonewall. But because the time allotted for the destruction of Lee's army, wing by isolated wing, was running out. Such fear as he felt was that Jackson would make his escape and rejoin Longstreet, who by now would be moving to meet him. Pope's dismay was short-lived, however. After nightfall, two dispatches reached him that changed everything and sent his spirits soaring higher than ever. The first informed him that Longstreet's column, after penetrating Thoroughfare Gap, had been driven back to the west side of Bull Run Mountain. This afforded considerable relief, allowing, as it did, additional time in which to catch the rebel host divided. But the best news of all came just before 10 o'clock. Late that afternoon, marching as ordered toward Centerville, one of McDowell's divisions had found Jackson lurking in the woods beside the Warrenton Turnpike, 2 miles short of Stonebridge, and had flushed him. There on the field of last year's battle, Pope wired Halleck, a severe fight took place, which was terminated by darkness. The enemy was driven back at all points, and thus the affair rests. Determined not to let it rest there long, he sent peremptory orders to the commanders of his 5 converging corps for the execution of a plan he improvised then and there, for the absolute destruction of his just-found adversary. McDowell and Siegel, with 30,000 men, would attack at dawn from the south and west, blocking any possible withdrawal by way of Thoroughfare Gap, while Heintzelman, Porter, and Reno, with another 30,000, would attack from the east, twin hammers whose concerted blows would pound to a pulp the 23,000 butternut marauders pinned to the anvil by their own commander. Pope's instructions were explicit. Assault him vigorously at daylight in the morning. Exultant, and with cause, Jackson's 14 gray brigades were about to be mauled simultaneously by 34 in blue, 17 from one direction, 17 from another, he added, "I see no possibility of his escape." Stoutly conceived though the plan was, and stoutly though he strove to put it into execution, Pope was again the victim of several misconceptions. For one thing, Jackson was not trapped, nor was he trying to escape. He very much wanted to be where he was, and he very much hoped that Pope could be persuaded to attack him, whatever the odds. In fact, if he could have been at federal headquarters with control over the messages coming and going, he scarcely would have changed a line in a single one of them. His luck was in, and he knew it, the old valley luck, by which even his worst errors worked to his advantage. The night march out of Manassas, for example. When Ewell came up from Bristow about sunset, having disengaged from the skirmish with Hooker's division across Broad Run, Stonewall gave these late arrivers a chance at the fag end of the feast. "What we got was not of a kind to invigorate," one cannoneer grumbled, consisting as it did of hardtack, pickled oysters, and canned stuff generally. Then put all 3 divisions in motion while the rear guard set fire to the picked-over wreckage left behind. What followed, as the troops slogged more or less northward in 3 columns, looking back over their shoulders at the spreading glow of flames, was one of the worst executed marches in the history of his command. Heavy-stomached, with bulging haversacks and pockets, the men fell by the wayside or crawled under bushes to sleep off their excesses of food and drink. The result was confusion and a great deal of lost time as the file closers probed the countryside, rounding them up and persuading them to fall back into column. Tolliver did best, moving almost due north up the Sudley Springs Road to Groveton, the designated point of concentration, where that road intersected the Warrenton Turnpike. Hill did worst. He went all the way to Centerville, then swung west. Ewell, following Hill for a time, crossed Bull Run at Blackburn's Ford, then recrossed it at Stone Bridge, Hill coming along somewhere behind. Morning found the three divisions badly scattered and dangerously exposed. It was midday before they were reunited at Groveton. For this there were various causes: Jackson's sketchy instructions, inefficient guides, the droves of stragglers. But even this blundering performance worked to Stonewall's advantage, providing as it did the basis for the conflicting federal reports of his whereabouts, which led Pope off on a tangential pursuit. Whatever blame he deserved for the confusion in all three columns along the way, Jackson had chosen their destination with care and daring. A rapid withdrawal to rejoin Lee beyond the mountains was in order, but it was not Stonewall's way to turn his back on a situation, no matter how risky, so long as possible benefits remained within his reach. Tomorrow or the next day, Longstreet would be coming down through Thoroughfare Gap or up the Warrenton Turnpike. At Groveton, Jackson knew from last year's extended stay in the area, there was an excellent covered position in which to await old Pete's arrival by either route, and if the pressure grew too great, his line of retreat would be reasonably secure. Meanwhile, the Federals, or as he preferred to express it, a kind providence, might afford him a chance at the infliction of another terrible wound. About midday, when he finally got his scattered divisions back together, he put the men in position just north of the turnpike, behind a low ridge and under cover of some woods. One soldier later remembered that they were packed in there like herring in a barrel. They stacked arms and lounged about, all 23,000 of them, minus stragglers, snoozing, playing cards, and munching at more of the good things they had in their haversacks by courtesy of Commissary Pope. The bands were silent, the troops were instructed not to shout. But as that same soldier remembered it, there were no restrictions as to laughing and talking, and the woods sounded like the hum of a beehive in the warm sunshine. Jackson himself remained on the ridge, which afforded a clear view of the pike in both directions. When a report arrived that a strong Union column was advancing from Gainesville, he moved Tolliver and Ewell 2 miles west and posted them in the woods adjacent to the pike for a surprise attack on the flank of the passing bluecoats. Nothing came of this. The column turned off south toward Manassas before it came abreast. Stonewall was cross and restless, reminding one observer of an explosive missile, an unlucky spark applied to which would blow you sky high. Lee had told him to avoid a general engagement, but he did not like to see the Federals escape the ambush he had laid. Besides, he knew now that reinforcements from the peninsula were at Alexandria, better than 30,000 of them, in addition to the 2 corps already joined. If Pope withdrew in that direction, the combined might of his and McClellan's forces would be too great for a strike at them, even after Lee arrived with Longstreet. So Jackson continued to patrol the ridge, trotting back and forth on his horse, peering up and down the pike. His staff and several brigade and regimental commanders sat their mounts at a respectful distance, not wanting to come near him in his present frame of mind or take a chance on interrupting his prayers that Providence would send another blue column into the trap the first had avoided. Along toward sunset, his prayers were answered after the flesh. A well-closed Federal column was approaching, trudging hard up the turnpike in the direction of Stone Bridge, flankers out. Jackson rode down off the ridge for a closer look and trotted back and forth within easy musket range of the bluecoats, who gave him no more attention than a casual rebel cavalryman deserved. Back on the ridge, the officers watched in horror and fascination. "We could almost tell his thoughts by his movements," one declared. Sometimes he would halt, then trot on briskly, halt again, wheel his horse, and pass again along the flank of the marching column. They thought they knew what he would do, and presently he did it. When the head of the blue column drew abreast, he whirled and galloped back toward the group on the ridge. "Here he comes, by God," one shouted. Jackson pulled up, touched his cap, and said calmly, "Bring your men up, gentlemen." At this, they turned and rode fast toward the woods where the infantry was waiting. The men had been watching their officers with much interest, the same observer remarked, and when they wheeled and dashed toward them they knew what it meant, and from the woods arose a hoarse roar like that from cages of wild animals at the scent of blood. The artillery led off. Three batteries emerged from the woods, went into position in the open, and began to slam away at the compact column on the pike. As the cannonade got underway, Tolliver's men swarmed down the slope, yelling as they came, the battle flags of the Stonewall Brigade gleaming blood red in the fading light. The result should have been panic, for the bluecoats taken thus unawares were from Rufus King's division, specifically John Gibbon's brigade of four regiments, three from Wisconsin and one from Indiana, one of the largest but also one of the greenest in Pope's conglomerate command. However, instead of panicking at this abrupt baptism of fire, the Westerners wheeled to meet the attackers and stopped them in their tracks with massed volleys. Gibbon was regular army, loyal to the Union despite the fact that three of his North Carolina brothers went with the Stars and Bars. Supported by two regiments sent forward from Abner Doubleday's brigade, he handled his troops skillfully, holding off Tolliver, who presently was reinforced by two brigades from Ewell. What ensued, first by the red glare of sunset, then on through dusk and twilight into darkness, with 2,800 Federals facing nearly twice as many Confederates, was one of the hardest close-quarter fights of the whole war. Jackson did not attempt to maneuver. Contrary to his usual practice once the advance had stalled, he was content to let the weight of numbers settle the issue. In point of fact, however, neither the pressure nor the savagery of his veterans settled anything at all. If the Wisconsin and Indiana farm boys were in a hopeless predicament, outnumbered nearly 2-1 by fighters whose fame was the highest in either army, they did not seem to recognize the odds. Experience had afforded them nothing by way of comparison. For all they knew, combat was supposed to be like this. The opposing lines stood face to face, parade style, and slugged it out for 2 solid hours. Gibbon, who at 35 had a long career ahead of him, said afterwards that this was the heaviest infantry fire he ever heard, and Tolliver referred to the engagement as one of the most terrific conflicts that can be conceived of. Finally, the firing slacked. By 9 o'clock, it died away by mutual consent. The Federals withdrew across the turnpike unpursued. More than 1,000 of them had fallen, well over 1/3 of the number engaged. The 2nd Wisconsin, which had gone into the fight 500 strong, came out with 202, having begun tonight to establish the record it would set before the war was over, by having more of its members killed in combat than any other regiment in the U.S. Army. Gibbon and Doubleday wondered what to do. Their latest orders called for a march on Centerville. But if the 2-hour fight proved nothing else, it certainly had proved that the way was blocked in that direction. King was sick in an ambulance. No one knew where McDowell was. He was, in fact, lost in the woods, having strayed from the pike in the darkness, and would not himself know where he was till morning. So Gibbon and Doubleday, conferring with the ailing King, decided that the best thing to do would be to swing on down to Manassas, the original objective, taking such of their wounded along as could be recovered from the field. Grass green 3 hours ago, the Western soldiers fell back in and set off down the road as veterans. They were known as the Black Hat Brigade, Gibbon having seen to it that they were equipped with non-regulation black felt hats. In time, the rebels, too, would know them by that name. "Here come them damn black hat fellers," the gray pickets would yell. But presently they changed it. Within a month, they were calling themselves the Iron Brigade. Few men anywhere were inclined to question their right to call themselves by any name they fancied, least of all Tolliver's and Ewell's, who had suffered about as heavily as the troops they sought to ambush. The Stonewall Brigade took 635 soldiers into the twilight conflict and came out with 425, a ghost of the proud 3,000-man command that won its nom de guerre on nearby Henry Hill the year before, and then passed through the glory of the Valley Campaign and the carnage of the 7 Days. Some of its most famous regiments were reduced to the size of a small company. The 27th Virginia, for example, was down to a scant 24 men by the time the firing stopped. Murderous as these figures were, they told but part of the story, for they included a high percentage of officers of all ranks. The 2nd Virginia had only one captain and one lieutenant left with the colors, and others were stripped almost as bare of leaders. Nor were the losses restricted to those of field and company grade. This fight brought down generals, too, including two of the three ranking just under Jackson himself. Tolliver, who had succeeded Winder less than 3 weeks ago, was thrice wounded. He kept on his feet till the melee ended, but then bled white, was carried off the field. His successor, Brigadier General William E. Stark, a former New Orleans cotton man, professionally untrained in arms, had been promoted on the eve of Cedar Mountain and had led a brigade in action for the first time tonight. Now, suddenly, he found himself in command of the most famous of all Confederate divisions. The other high-ranking casualty was Ewell. Unable to resist the lure of close-up combat, he had gone forward to direct a charge by the 21st Georgia. As he knelt, squinting under the smoke for a glimpse of the enemy line, several of the Georgians called out proudly, "Here's General Ewell, boys!" Whereupon the Federals, hearing the cheering, cut loose with heavy volleys in that direction. The regiment scattered, taking such losses here and elsewhere, that it emerged from the battle with only 69 of its 242 men unhurt. Old Baldhead himself was found on the field when the fight was over, unconscious from loss of blood, one knee badly shattered by a minie. The surgeons assessed the damage and pronounced the verdict: amputation. Apparently he was out of the war for good. His successor was Alexander R. Lawton, who had held the rank of brigadier for 16 months, longer than any other general in the army, apparently because Jackson, who had bypassed him in favor of Winder, did not consider him competent for divisional command. Now, as a result of attrition, his seniority could no longer be denied. Any fight that cost the Confederacy the services of the profane and eccentric Ewell, along with those of the fast-developing Tolliver, and nearly 1,000 other veterans of all ranks, could scarcely be called an unclouded victory, no matter who held the field when the smoke cleared. Moreover, Jackson himself had displayed symptoms of a relapse into tactical lethargy once the thing was underway. Yet if he felt either dismay or dissatisfaction at being thus deprived of two of his three chief lieutenants, all in fact but the one he trusted least, the thin-skinned and erratic A.P. Hill, he showed no signs of it any more than he showed signs of apprehension for what Pope would surely try to do to him tomorrow. He seemed, in fact, according to one of his soldiers, calm as a May morning. What was left of the night he devoted to sleep. Purposely, as if with a shout of boo in the game of blind man's buff he was playing, he had attracted Pope's attention, hoping to hold him there by absorbing his attacks until Lee arrived with Longstreet and made possible a shift to the offensive he preferred. Longstreet was nearer than Jackson knew, near enough even to have heard the tearing rattle of musketry in the twilight west of Groveton, 6 miles off, and to wonder at the silence that ensued. For Lee, who was with the approaching column, this was one more enigma to be added to the many that had fretted him since Stonewall marched away 4 days ago. The first day had been spent continuing the artillery demonstration along the Rappahannock. That night, after wiring Davis to ask if more troops could be spared from the Richmond defenses, he sent Stuart off with all the cavalry. Next morning, August 26th, he continued the cannonade, hoping to keep Pope's attention fixed on his front, while Jackson moved around his flank to strike his rear. By midday, however, there were signs that the Federals were beginning to pull back, which might or might not mean that the ruse had been detected. Lee sent for Longstreet. The time had come to reunite the two wings of the army, he said, and he left to him the choice of routes, either up the Warrenton Pike or roundabout through Salem. Old Pete chose the latter, leaving Major General R. H. Anderson's division, formerly Huger's, to hold the fords and mask the movement. He set out that afternoon with his other three divisions, Hood's, reinforced by Shanks Evans, whose brigade had come up from South Carolina, Brigadier General D.R. Jones's, formerly half of Magruder's, and Longstreet's own, now split in two under Brigadier Generals Cadmus Wilcox and James Kemper. This gave him, in effect, five divisions, each with three brigades, 32,000 men in all. He made 11 miles before bivouacking near Orléans after nightfall, and by noon of the following day the head of the column had passed through Salem, matching the performance of Stonewall's fabled marchers over these same roads 36 hours ago. That was gratifying, indeed. Even more so, however, were two dispatches Lee received before going into bivouac on the outskirts of White Plains. The first was from Jackson, informing him that he had taken Bristow and Manassas the night before. He was concentrating now at the latter place, he added, squarely in Pope's rear, and saw no evidence so far that the Federals were massing against him. The second welcome dispatch, brought by a courier from the opposite direction, was from Davis, replying to Lee's request for reinforcements. They were on the way, the president told him. Wade Hampton's cavalry brigade and two divisions of infantry under Harvey Hill and Major General Lafayette McLaws, the latter having been assigned the other half of Magruder's old command. Howls of protest might ordinarily be expected when his critics learned that the seat of government was being stripped of defenders, Davis said. But confidence in you overcomes the view which would otherwise be taken of the exposed condition of Richmond, and the troops retained for the defense of the capital are surrendered to you on a new request. Lee's anxiety, both for the present and the future, was considerably relieved. In addition to the badly needed brigade of cavalry, he had none at all for the screening of Longstreet's column. Riding point that morning near Salem, he and his staff had barely avoided capture by a roving Federal squadron. The arrival of the promised 10 brigades of infantry would add 17,000 veteran bayonets to his army. That would by no means even the odds Pope and Burnside and McClellan could bring to bear, combined, but it would at any rate reduce them to the vicinity of 2 to 1, 150,000 versus 72,000. If the present odds were less heartening, McClellan, after all, might be with Pope already. In other respects, the situation appeared quite promising. Reinforcements on the way, Jackson astride the railroad in Pope's rear, the main Union supply base up in flames, all this was much. Besides which, it held out interesting possibilities for maneuver. Manassas being just 22 miles from White Plains, Longstreet's present bivouac, Lee could reasonably expect to have the two wings of his army reunited by tomorrow night, prepared to undertake the completion of the suppression already begun. Before dawn, more good news arrived. Jackson informed him by courier that he was withdrawing from his exposed position at Manassas and would concentrate at Groveton, thus reducing by 3 full miles the interval between himself and Longstreet. Refreshed by sleep, old Pete's veterans swung off into a rising sun that seemed destined to shine today on a reunited Army of Northern Virginia. Only one natural obstacle lay in their path, Thoroughfare Gap. If the Yankees held it in strength, there would be the delay of an uphill fight or a roundabout march, either of which would throw the schedule out of kilter. This seemed unlikely, though, since Jackson's couriers had been coming through unhindered, and presently another arrived, bringing further assurance that the pass was open and that his chief had reached Groveton, unmolested and unobserved, and was concentrating his troops in the woods overlooking the turnpike at that place. At 3 o'clock, topping the final rise that brought the gap into view, Longstreet's Lee division pushed rapidly forward. Back with the main body, Lee presently heard from up ahead the reverberant clatter of musketry in the gorge. Its echoes were wonderful, one staff officer later recalled. A gun fired in its depths gave forth roars fit to bring down the skies. Lee's reaction was less aesthetic, for this of all sounds was the one he least wanted to hear. Then came the message that confirmed his fears. The Federals not only held the pass itself, they also had a reserve line posted on a dominant ridge beyond. John Pope had turned the tables, it seemed. Instead of panicking when he found Stonewall interposed between himself and Washington, the Union commander apparently had seized the initiative and posted his superior force between the two Confederate wings, preparing to crush them in sequence. This was the darkest possible view, but Longstreet, that undismayed warrior his chief of staff afterwards called him, adding that he was like a rock in steadiness when sometimes in battle the world seemed flying to pieces, put his troops at once in motion to test the validity of such gloom, while Jones, supported by Kemper, kept up the pressure dead ahead, Hood probed for an opening near at hand, and Wilcox set out for Hopewell Gap, 3 miles north. These dispositions took time. Near sunset, during lulls in the firing here at the pass, Lee heard from the direction of Groveton the mutter of distant musketry mixed in with the grumble of guns. This was presently blotted out, however, by the stepped-up firing close at hand. Hood's men had found a cleft in the ridge and were on the Federal flank. Promptly, the bluecoats retreated, unplugging the gap and withdrawing from the ridge beyond. They were only a single division, after all, sent by McDowell on his own initiative, shortly before he wandered off and got himself lost in the woods. Jones and Kemper marched through unopposed, joining Hood on the eastern slope, and the three divisions settled down to await the arrival of Wilcox, who had likewise penetrated Hopewell Gap. Now that their own guns were silent, they heard again the growl and rumble of those near Groveton, half a dozen miles away. The uproar swelled to climax, then it sank. At 9 o'clock it stopped. This might mean almost anything. All that was certain was that Jackson had been engaged. Whether he had won or lost, whether, indeed, that wing of the army still existed, they would know tomorrow. Whichever it was over now. After sending a courier to inform Stonewall that the main body was safely through the pass, Lee told Longstreet to bed his men down for a good night's sleep in preparation for a fast march at sunup. Friday, August 29th, Hood's troops took the lead, marching so fast that their commander later reported proudly, "General Longstreet sent me orders 2 or 3 times to halt, since the army was unable to keep within supporting distance of my forces." There was need for haste. Ahead, the guns were booming again, and a great white bank of smoke was piling up against the hot, bright blue, windless sky. Comforting, though this was, as proof that Jackson's men were still alive and kicking, it also demonstrated Pope's determination to destroy them before reinforcements got there. The Texans pushed on through Haymarket, raising a red cloud of dust with their feet, then down to Gainesville, where they struck the Warrenton Turnpike and swung left, advancing another 3 miles toward the ground-jarring thunder of guns, until they came upon Stonewall's right flank above Groveton. It was now about 10 o'clock. Lee's army was reunited. Hood went into position north of the pike, establishing contact, and the other divisions filed into position on his right, extending the line generally southward, across the pike and down toward the Manassas Gap Railroad. From left to right, Longstreet's order of battle was Hood, Kemper, Jones, Wilcox. Anderson, who had masked the withdrawal from the Rappahannock line, was due to arrive by nightfall. Moving from the scene of last night's bloody encounter, Jackson had placed his three divisions along the grade of an unfinished railroad. Part cut, part fill, it furnished an excellent defensive position, practically a ready-made system of entrenchments, roughly parallel to the turnpike across which Longstreet's line was drawn. When the valley soldiers heard that their comrades had completed the march from Thoroughfare Gap and were filing into position on the right, covered with dust so thick, one cavalryman observed, that all looked as if they had been painted one color, they rose and cheered them, despite the cannonade, which had scarcely slacked since sunup. Presently, though, they had more to worry about than bursting shells. The blue infantry was swarming to the attack. The Federal chieftain's plans for a simultaneous double blow at both of Stonewall's flanks had gone astray. Porter having been delayed by darkness and two of the missing McDowell's three divisions having fallen back on Manassas after their twilight fights at Groveton and the Gap. "God damn McDowell, he's never where I want him," Pope was saying, angry but undaunted. He sent staff officers to locate them and hurry them along. Meanwhile, Siegel, Reno, and Heintzelman were at hand, and he flung them forward, still convinced that Jackson was trying to escape. One after another, they surged across the open fields, breaking in waves against the embankment where Stonewall's bayonets glittered. The closest they came to success was on the rebel left, where some woods afforded a covered approach. This was on Little Powell's front, the extreme flank of which was held by Brigadier General Maxie Gregg's South Carolinians. Kearney's division struck hard here, effecting a lodgment astride the ramp and pressing down on the end of the line as if to roll it up. On a rocky knoll here on the far east margin of the conflict, Rebs and Yanks fought hand to hand. Bayonets crossed, rifle butts cracked skulls. A bachelor lawyer, somewhat deaf, Gregg strode up and down, brandishing an old revolutionary scimitar and calling for a rally. "Let us die here, my men! Let us die here!" he said. Many did die, something over 600 in all, but the knoll was held. The Federals withdrew. Hill did not think it would be for long. He sent word to Jackson that he would do his best, but that he doubted whether his men could withstand another such assault. Jackson sent the courier back with a sharp message. Tell him if they attack him again, he must beat them. Riding toward the left to see for himself, he met the red-haired Hill coming to speak to him in person. General, your men have done nobly, Jackson told him. If you are attacked again, you will beat the enemy back. At this, the clatter broke out again in the woods on the left. Here it comes, Hill said. As he turned his horse and rode back into the uproar, Jackson called after him, I'll expect you to beat them. The clatter rose to climax, then subsided. A messenger came galloping out of the smoke and pulled up alongside Jackson. General Hill presents his respects and says the attack of the enemy was repulsed. Jackson smiled. Tell him I knew he would do it, he said. That was how it went, touch and go, all along his line all afternoon. Pope paid no mind to Longstreet, being unaware that he was even on the field, which indeed might practically as well have been the case, so far as relief of the pressure on Jackson was concerned, except for some batteries in brisk action on a ridge to Hood's left where the lines were hinged, like widespread jaws gaping east-southeast. Lee was quick to suggest that old Pete swing the lower jaw forward and upward in order to engage the bluecoats and absorb some of the single-minded pressure they were applying to the weary men along the unfinished railroad. But Longstreet demurred. He never liked to go piecemeal into battle unprepared. Anderson was not yet up, and he had not had time enough for a thorough study of the ground. Besides, Stuart reported a force of undetermined strength gathering on the right. This, too, would have to be investigated. Regretfully, Lee agreed to a delay. Longstreet left on a personal reconnaissance, then presently returned. He did not like the look of things. More Federals were coming up from the south, he said, in position to stab at his flank if he moved east. If they would venture squarely into the jaws, he would gladly clamp and chew them with gusto, but for the present he saw little profit and much risk in advancing. Jackson rode up, dusty and worn. The two generals greeted him, and in reply to his statement that his line was hard-pressed, Lee turned to Longstreet. "Hadn't we better move our line forward?" he suggested. "I think not," Longstreet said. "We had better wait until we hear more from Stuart about the force he has reported moving against us from Manassas." A step up in the firing toward the east caused Jackson to ride off in that direction. Federal dead and wounded were heaped along the forward slope where the Confederates, drawing their beads under cover of the cuts and fills, had dropped them. Charge after charge was repulsed all down the line, but this was accomplished at a high cost to the badly outnumbered defenders, especially when the fighting was conducted at close quarters, as it often was today. In Stark's division on the right, not a single brigade was under a general officer, and one was led by a major. In Lawton's, when bull-voiced old Ike Trimble was hit and carried from the field, command of his brigade passed for a time to a captain. For the survivors, fighting their battle unrelieved and unsupported, this was the longest of all days. One remembered years afterward how he spent the infrequent lulls praying that the great red sun, blazing and motionless overhead, would go down. He added, looking back, "For the first time in my life I understood what was meant by Joshua's sun standing still on Gibeon, for it would not go down." At last, however, as it approached the land line, Lee suggested for the third time that Longstreet attack, but Longstreet still demurred. Stuart had identified the hovering bluecoats as Porter's Corps, two veteran divisions. Besides, old Pete had a new objection. There was too little daylight left. The best thing to do, he said, would be to make a forced reconnaissance at dusk. Then, if an opening was discovered, the whole army could exploit it at dawn tomorrow. Once more, Lee deferred to Longstreet, who assigned the task to Hood. The Texans moved out at sunset, advancing up the Warrenton Turnpike. "The light of battle in our eyes, I reckon," one recalled, "and fear of it in our hearts, I know." They collided in the dusk with King's division, returning from Manassas, in a fight so confused that one Union major was captured when he tried to rally a regiment that turned out to be the 2nd Mississippi. Hood held his ground, driving the weary Federals back. But when he reported to Lee and Longstreet after dark, he recommended that his troops be withdrawn to their original position. Nor did he think that an attack next morning would succeed in that direction. The enemy position was too strong, he said. Thus, Longstreet's day-long judgment was apparently confirmed. Lee gave Hood permission to withdraw, which he did, encountering in the darkness the men of Anderson's division, just arrived from Thoroughfare Gap, and thus prevented them from stumbling blindly into the Union lines. The long day's fight was over. Out across the night-shrouded fields and in the woods behind the corpse-strewn embankment, the groans of the wounded were incessant. "Water! For God's sake, water!" men were crying. Jackson's medical director, reporting the heavy casualties to his chief, said proudly, "General, this day has been won by nothing but stark and stern fighting." Stonewall shook his head. "No," he said, "it has been won by nothing but the blessing and protection of Providence." Dawn found Pope in excellent spirits. His headquarters were on a little knoll in the northeast quadrant formed by the intersection of the Manassas-Sudley Road with the Warrenton Turnpike. And as he stood there in the growing light, burly and expansive, smoking a cigar and chatting informally with his staff and those commanders who found time to ride over for a visit, the gruffness, which was habitual, one of his aides referred to it as infusing some of his Western energy into the caravan, seemed merely a form of bantering this morning, pleased as he was with the overall success of his efforts to keep Stonewall from escaping. He had cast his net and the foe was entangled. Now all that remained apparently was the agreeable task of hauling him in, hand over hand. By no means had all gone to suit him yesterday. The attacks, though pressed with vigor, had been delivered somewhat piecemeal. Most irksome of all, Fitzjohn Porter had declined to advance against Jackson's right flank, claiming that Longstreet barred the way with something like 3 times as many men as he himself had. Pope did not believe this for an instant. At 4:30 he repeated his orders for Porter to press forward into action at once on the enemy's flank and, if possible, on his rear. Porter balked, still insisting that he had more than half of the rebel army to his front, and darkness fell before Pope could budge him. Disappointed, the Federal commander moved the sluggish Porter around to the main line, paralleling the turnpike, and prepared for an all-out assault at dawn, when he wired Halleck a summary of his achievements. "We fought a terrific battle here yesterday, which lasted with continuous fury from daybreak until dark, by which time the enemy was driven from the field which we now occupy. Our troops are too much exhausted yet to push matters, but I shall do so in the course of the morning. The enemy is still in our front, but badly used up. We have lost not less than 8,000 men killed and wounded, but from the appearance of the field, the enemy lost at least 2-1. He stood strictly on the defensive, and every assault was made by ourselves. Our troops behaved splendidly. The battle was fought on the identical battlefield of Bull Run, which greatly increased the enthusiasm of our men. In mid-paragraph, he added, "The news just reaches me from the front that the enemy is retreating toward the mountains. I go forward at once to see." He did go forward, onto the knoll at any rate, and what he saw encouraged him still more. Where bayonets had glittered yesterday along the bed of the unfinished railroad, the goal of so many charges that had broken in blood along its base, today there was stillness and apparent vacancy. Only a few gray riflemen contested the sniping from Federal outposts. Combined with the knowledge of Hood's withdrawal down the turnpike after midnight, this intelligence led Pope to believe that Jackson had pulled out, leaving only a skeleton force to discourage the blue pursuit. Still, anxious though he was to garner the utmost fruits of victory, Pope curbed his tendency toward rashness. In the end, he knew more would be gained if the chase was conducted in a well-coordinated fashion than if he took off half-cocked and over-eager. While he stood there on the headquarters knoll, wreathed in cigar smoke as he chatted with his staff, orders went out prescribing the dispositions for pursuit. McDowell would be in general charge of the two-pronged advance. Porter's corps and two divisions from McDowell's would move directly down the pike. Heintzelman's corps, supported by McDowell's other division, would move up the Haymarket Road. With Stonewall's getaway thus contested in both directions, troop commanders were expressly instructed to press him vigorously during the whole day. All this took time, but Pope felt he could afford it now that he had a full-scale victory under his belt. Careful preparations, with strict attention to details, would pay dividends in the long run when the rebels were brought to bay and the mopping up began. Noon came and went. A heavy silence lay over the heat-shimmered field, broken from time to time by sputters of fire exchanged by the men on outpost. At 2 o'clock, informed that all was in order at last, Pope gave the signal, and the pursuit got under way. Deliberate though these preparations were, the pursuit itself, or anyhow what Pope conceived as such, was probably the briefest of the war. Jackson was by no means retreating. He had merely withdrawn his troops for some unmolested and hard-earned rest in the woods along the base of Sudley Mountain just in his rear, leaving a thin line to man the works and give the alarm in case the Yankees showed signs of advancing. He doubted that they would do so after their failures yesterday, but he was perfectly willing to meet them if they tried it. Longstreet, who was very much on hand with all five of his divisions, no matter what evidence Pope had received or deduced in denial of the fact, was more than willing. He was downright eager. In fact, now that Porter's corps had been shifted from its threatening position off his flank, he desired nothing in all the world quite so much as that the Federals would launch a full-scale attack across his front, though he too doubted that fortune's smile could ever be that broad. Lee, who doubted it most of all, began to be concerned that Pope would get away unsuppressed, having suffered only such punishment as Jackson had managed to inflict while receiving his headlong charges the day before. As the long morning wore away, marked by nothing more eventful than the occasional growl of a battery or the isolated sputter of an argument between pickets, Lee took the opportunity to catch up on his correspondence. "My desire," he wrote the president, "has been to avoid a general engagement, being the weaker force, and by maneuvering to relieve the portion of the country referred to." By this he meant the region along the Rappahannock, whose relief had been accomplished by forcing Pope's retreat on Manassas. Now his mind turned to the possibilities at hand. If Pope would not attack, then he would have to be maneuvered. About noon, while Lee was working on a plan for moving again around his opponent's right, crossing Bull Run above Sudley Springs in order to threaten his rear, Stuart came to headquarters with an interesting report. He had sent a man up a large walnut tree, Jeb said, and the man had spotted the bluecoats massing in three heavy lines along Jackson's front. Quickly, Lee sent couriers to warn of the danger. Jackson alerted his troops but kept them in the woods. He had been observing the Federal activity for some time, but concluding that nothing would come of it, had remarked to the colonel commanding the Stonewall Brigade, "Well, it looks as if there will be no fight today." Shortly before 3 o'clock, he found out just how wrong he was. Suddenly, without even the warning preamble of an artillery bombardment, the blue infantry came roaring at him in three separate waves, stretching left and right as far as the eye could see. Buglers along the unfinished railroad gobbled staccato warnings, and the startled troops came running out of the woods to man the line. This was far worse than yesterday. Not only were the attacking forces much heavier, they seemed much more determined, individually and in mass, not to be denied a lodgment. Immediately, Jackson began to receive urgent requests for reinforcements all along the front. One officer rode up to report that his brigade commander had been shot down and the survivors were badly shaken. They needed help. "What brigade, sir?" Jackson asked, not having caught the name. "The Stonewall Brigade." "Go back," Jackson told him. "Give my compliments to them and tell the Stonewall Brigade to maintain her reputation." For the present, reduced though it was to a ghost of its former self, the brigade managed to do as its old commander asked. But how long it would be able to continue to do so under the strain was another question. Rifle barrels grew too hot to handle, and at several points the defenders exhausted their ammunition. At one such critical location, the enemy